Welcome to Money Maze Curated Podcasts. We created this spin-off channel to highlight a selection of innovative firms in the finance sector and beyond. If you visit www.moneymazepodcast.com, you can also sign up to our newsletter to keep up to date with episode releases and access a range of resources and materials relevant to each guest. If you enjoy this episode, please follow this channel and leave a review. Thank you for listening. So today Madrid comes to London. So es un gran placer darle la bienvenida hoy a Samantha Ricciardi. Samantha, welcome.
Thank you, Simon. Muchas gracias.
That's where my Spanish stops. So it's the 10th of June, 2024. We're here in London and we're going to talk about an institution that everybody knows, Banco Santander. But what not everybody knows is this very substantial investment management practice that they have and which Samantha is responsible for as the CEO. So I hope we can discover quite a lot about what you do and why you do it. And also, we haven't talked in the podcasts, I think, for a very long time, if at all, about what's going on in Latin America. So we will hopefully later on talk about that. But what intrigued me a little bit as I ran through your history is you'd spent time at Citibank, Schroders, and BlackRock before 2 years ago moving to be the CEO of Santander Asset Management. And each of these institutions can leave a good or bad mark, but particularly in terms of learning lessons, they're all highly respected firms. What might have stayed with you that is helpful in your new job?
Those have all been amazing places where I've certainly learned a lot, different things in different places. But the one thing, if I had to pick one thing that really stuck with me, is striving for excellence in everything that we do. And let me maybe unfold that for a moment. And that has been what has been the most helpful for me at Santander, is really thinking about clients and what do clients need. And when you're thinking about what decision to make in either way, is when you ask yourself what's right for the client, that will always be the right answer.
So I suppose the allied question is moving through these organizations with increasing seniority, Santander came calling or not, but what was it that you saw in Santander that intrigued you?
Great question. A couple of things I would say. First of all, and I'm going to be very blunt in my answer, is when you're called to say you're going to be the CEO and running a company from A to Z, that is always very appealing. It's amazing to work for massive companies such as BlackRock or Schroders or Citi, but really being able to be responsible for the whole A to Z, being the CEO, was very attractive. That's one. And the second thing I would also say is I am Mexican, and there is that attraction of thinking, okay, there's a big connection for Santander and Santander Asset Management to Latin America, and that certainly made that appealing as well.
So let's set the stage. Maybe you can just summarize for listeners the Santander Asset Management business, and the key takeaways, asset size, people, geographies.
And let me start maybe by one thing first, is Santander Asset Management has a little over 50 years, but it has mainly always been the asset manager for Santander, the bank. And that's probably why most of your listeners wouldn't necessarily know who Santander Asset Management is, because we've always really been there to accompany the bank's clients in their investment needs. But having said that, we are now almost $230 billion in assets under management. We're across 10 countries. We have around 850 people, of which 226 are investors. And we're very prominent in Latin America, Europe, and that's pretty much where it ends.
And if we then think about your investment pillars and the classic sort of question of what you think you are really good at, just help me understand that.
Of course. So when I'm asked, what are you really good at? Because you're right, that's usually an investment management what you're known for is Latin America, both on the fixed income side as well as equities. I know we'll talk later more about Latin America per se as an asset class, but we're definitely very good in both of those instances. And then what we've mostly focused on that maybe isn't the sexiest product you've ever heard of is thinking about multi-asset and balanced portfolios, because that's usually what we do for our clients here in Europe.
So you do have quite an important and unusual perspective, which is the sort of the lens on South America. So I definitely want to come back in terms of, you know, thinking about local fixed income as an asset class Let's go back to the balance mandate, the multi-asset mandate. Just tell me about a little how you put your investment team together, and ultimately what I'm driving at is how would you define your investment philosophy?
Great question. And I think having, again, going back to what I've done in the past, it's always interesting, I think, how the evolution has been of multi-asset portfolios and what really makes the difference there. And clearly where we're really wanting to focus on is to make sure that our asset allocation team is really top-notch. At the end of the day, I think that when you have really good building blocks, the value add that you can really bring, especially in this day and age, is really by looking at the asset allocation per se and really building portfolios that are the right ones for the type of clients that you're selling to. So if I had to sum it up in one thing, we're focusing very much on having the A team for asset allocation with everything that that type of team would need to make the right decisions. And we're very much about tailoring for the type of clients that we're delivering towards that really have different risk profiles.
So the asset allocation has two components. One is the strategic and then the tactical, and then it's underlying that is the composition. Now, let's jump first of all to the composition. And I want to talk about passive active because you're trying to optimize a number of those things, and price or cost of running your own teams versus outsourcing passive is an important, you know, particularly if we move into a lower return world. How are you thinking about where passive fits?
You're absolutely right in saying that. I mean, passive is increasingly becoming such an important part of everything that we're doing. So we absolutely use passive where we really think it's going to reflect on the building block that we need. There is no view that we need to have active as an underlying. We want to make sure that we're just, whilst bringing everything together under our views of asset allocation, that we're using the right building block. And often, especially for markets such as US equities, it will be passive. And we want to make sure that where we're bringing the value in is by doing the asset allocation, both strategic as well as tactical.
Okay. And how do you build your teams to support that?
So we've undergone in the last, I would say, year and a half, a lot of change within that. And we really rethought how best to bring the best out of everyone. And we've made a fair amount of external hires to really reinforce the asset allocation teams. And we've made sure that we've really built a team that does research and then a team that does the implementation of the asset allocation, both at the strategic and tactical perspective. And I think what has been particularly interesting for us there is that we've really combined what the, if you want, global team is thinking, but we bring that in with all of the CIOs from each of the 10 countries where we're in. So that when we're making decisions, both on the strategic as well as tactical asset allocation, we're listening to the different views of people that have boots on the ground that are really bringing in their perspective into the committee of asset allocation.
So can you give us an example, we don't need any names, but of a sort of institution that comes to you and how you might address the problem they're trying to solve?
One thing that comes to mind, and maybe, again, that's the last long trip I've made, was going home to Mexico, but for business. And last week, we had a couple of our PMs from Mexico in Madrid because they were going, as a matter of fact, to talk to clients in the Middle East because there is appetite for this whole idea of nearshoring and really having a view on being able to invest in Mexican companies, but are the ones that are going to be taking advantage of the fact that they're delivering to the US market. So what we have seen a fair amount is from an asset allocation perspective, in certain instances, we have overweighted a couple of Mexican companies that we believe will benefit from nearshoring. But then we also have institutional clients that might turn to us and say, I want to be able to have exposure just to nearshoring because I do believe that there are a lot of companies that will set up their businesses in Mexico to be able to take advantage of the American market. So I think that those are kind of two examples of something very specific that plays out both on the asset allocation side that probably then ends up in a retail product for a European client. But we also might have institutional clients that say, that's a trend that I'm seeing is going to happen when probably the world becomes a bit more deglobalized. And I want to be able to take advantage of the growing market of the US without playing it directly on US equities.
And when you think about tactical allocation, you know, the question is how much risk you can introduce to any given portfolios and how much you want to deviate. And we've got this interesting intersection right now where a small number of companies are having a disproportionate influence, and it's not just in the US, it's also in Japan. There's potentially terrific value in all swathes of the mid-market listed, you know, universe, and value might be coming back. We were at the London Value Investor Conference and I was interviewing some managers there, most interest I'd seen in a number of years. So how do you think about how much rope will you give your asset allocators, given that you have a priority of trying to build a business with enough continuity and acceptable volatility?
Fair enough. I'm very much of a believer in really understanding. I'm going to go back to my concept of how important it is to understand who your client is and what your clients need. So if you still look at the way we're built at Santander Asset Management, is 80% of our clients are still retail clients or individuals in different parts of the world. So we're very thoughtful in terms of ensuring that whatever we're building fits to their profile and certainly from a risk perspective. And we really make sure that we use the right technology to ensure that we're delivering to that risk premium. When I then turn around and think about what are we doing for our institutional clients, I think that that's where we can become much more bespoke and where we're willing to take much more risk if the client is comfortable with that. So I think my answer to your question will be, it will depend so much more on what the clients need. But as of today, when I think of 80% of our assets geared towards people that are mostly in the retail and maybe in the mass affluent, we won't be going very much in terms of very high risk like products.
I understand. And unlike the institutional universe, the individual one is a universe that is probably a later adopter of technology. At least I might observe that, you might. How are you thinking about this sort of 5-year hence and how technology changes the investment proposition?
So technology seems to be the topic that we're always all on about. I'm sure you've been at dinners like those, but I've been at dinners where they look at me and say, you know, your team is going to disappear in terms of investments because it will be all done by AI. So I turn around and say, I always believe there's a role for both. We're big users of technology from an investment and a risk perspective, where we are able to see everything we have across the 10 countries in one single platform, and everyone's looking at the same data. And I think that that is the power of technology from an investment perspective, in really being able to see everything that you have, stress test all of your portfolios. But then there's still a human being that is going to be making the final decision with all of the information and all of the different charts and stress testings and so on that you will have been able to do. And I think that that's from an investment perspective. When I move again to the client perspective, I think what we are seeing, and I do believe that we will continue to see more of that, is the combination of personalized portfolios where, if you want to see it only digitally, you will. But if you want to be able to talk to someone after seeing whatever your proposal is digitally, you will be able to do that. I think that when we all think of robo-advisors maybe 10 years ago, we all thought we were going to be just doing robo-advisory by now, and we haven't. I still think that there's an element for both, where the client, as with Netflix or Amazon, you end up deciding how you want to see your investments. Do you just want to see them on the screen, or do you want to see them on the screen and talk to a person?
Right. And the other big force that has caused some in the industry, including one of your former employers, BlackRock, to row back is, of course, the whole subject of ESG. And I wonder how the conversation runs internally, because underlying that, of course, are some very important principles that none of us would argue with, and that might have been already being introduced without having this headline that created, you know, all sorts of opportunities to create specific product on sometimes, I won't say spurious so much as questionable basis. What advice do you give to your investment management teams in terms of how you'd like them to address these important issues that can be misconstrued?
I'll address your question, I think, in a couple of ways. One is, I personally feel that it is very unfortunate where ESG, at least where it feels like it is today, which it just seems like, there's less of a hype for it. Because I truly believe that that has to be a core part of what all asset managers really do. And I do feel that there's been a bit of a slowdown in the hype because clearly in 2022, the markets behaved in a way where everything that was non-ESG performed really well. But that was more due to what was happening around the world with energy and so on than because ESG was not the right investment. I think that's one. Then back to the other question of how do we really see ESG? And yes, within Santander Asset Management, we ensure that it is inbuilt across everything that we do, not just in investments, the way we look at risk. ESG is involved, the way we talk to our clients, ESG is involved. So where we basically land is we have all of the tools and all of the technology and all of the data available to be able to know what we're doing from an ESG perspective, but we do let the client decide what they want. If they want a product that is Article 6 or Article 8 or Article 9, we'll design that product for them, or we might have several already off the shelf. But it is at the end of the day for us a decision of the client, but we want to make sure that we have enough investment solutions that are ESG for that to be hopefully the first choice for our clients.
Got it. Now, of course, if we turn towards Latin America, there was always a commodity aspect to investing in some of those markets, which, you know, I haven't looked at the weightings, you know, for a while, so I'm maybe slightly out of touch. But tell me a little bit, I'd like to break my questioning to the inbound and the outbound capital flows. So let's just start with inbound. As you travel the world and talk to, you know, these various investment pools, what level of interest are you seeing and how is that being deployed?
Fair enough. What I can certainly say is institutional clients in Latin America, they will all want to have ESG portfolios. That isn't necessarily the case, to your point, of retail investors. So whether that's driven by regulation, as you have maybe in Europe, or whether it's driven by the fact that they're still very commodity-driven like countries, I'm not sure which one of the two is more of the push. But what certainly is the case is in the bigger countries of Latin America, like a Brazil or a Mexico, any institutional RFP will require you to have ESG principles in them. Hopefully that will then transpire more into individuals and clients, but at the moment, it certainly is with the institutional investors.
Let me just go up a step and just ask the question, putting ESG aside, what level of institutional interest from outside of Latin America are you seeing in terms of flows into the region?
That is a really good question that we were discussing on Friday with the team is, unfortunately, Latin America has certainly lost a fair amount. When you look at the size of Latin America within like a EM index compared to everything that has grown in Southeast Asia or China or India, it certainly has decreased enormously in the last 10 years. Having said that, it is still a region that does have a fair amount of appetite from certain countries, like the US. Pension plans in the US, for example, will have an important proportion in Latin America. And what I can speak for now is at least the Middle East does have interest for some of the countries in Latin America. So I guess in a nutshell, where I'm getting to is from a global perspective, it certainly lost a lot of space to Southeast Asia, China, and India. But it certainly still is a region that has appetite from a specific type of clients. And I think what has changed a bit in the last probably 5 or 6 years is the fact that people are seeing that they can play China through Brazil indirectly and the US with Mexico as well indirectly. And you're starting to see that type of interest in investments in those two countries specifically.
And just again, to help our listeners understand, and that would be because they, you know, if you might have a strong view on the secular demand story for copper, you know, one of the ways to play it might be to go and buy, you know, a CVRD or, you know, equivalent. So is it really Brazil and Mexico that are the predominant countries for the investment flows? Or is it actually, are you having discussions where people want to look at Colombian debt or...
Usually, Brazil and Mexico are the ones that will create the most appetite outside of Latin America. But if you're going to have a manager that wants to play something very specific, for example, like copper, then they might go to Chile and buy a couple of companies there because they produce copper. But in general, if you're talking to investors that want to be able to play Latin America more specifically, they will end up going to Brazil and Mexico.
So that's clear. What's very interesting from where you sit is this huge Spanish-speaking sort of, you know, continent, with the exception of Brazil, before somebody picks me up for not knowing Portuguese is spoken, but they have lived with two things that have peppered the landscape: devaluation and expropriation intermittently. So thinking about stronger currencies, everything is relative. The US dollar might appear to be strong to many. Some will argue that it continues to be eroded in terms of its purchasing power. Let's talk about outbound flows.
When you then look at institutional investors, you have massive pension funds in each country. Mexico has around $260 billion in DC pension plans. Brazil is still going through a lot of change in terms of DB to DC, but they have around triple the size of Mexico. But the way the regulation is set up for both countries is that in Mexico, it allows to invest up to 30% outside of Mexico. That doesn't mean offshore. It just means non-Mexican assets. And the institutional investors usually use around 70 or 80% of that exposure. Again, the Brazilians that have a much smaller allocation that can do foreign, they still invest locally. But mostly that responds to the fact that they've had interest rates at 15%. So I know that if you don't trust your real, then you maybe would go and do something else. But since they do trust their real, then they end up investing in their own fixed income. So at the end of the day, I would say that for both countries, it depends very much on whether it's people or institutional. But in both instances, they really do have massive institutional money that can invest outside of their home country. But Mexico will invest much more outside of Mexico than Brazil does.
That's very interesting. I mean, you could say for the Brazilians, it's a triumph of hope over experience, but we won't go into that. But I'm really interested in this emerging market debt. We had Manny Roman, the CEO of PIMCO, on a couple of months ago, and he talked about how, I suppose, excited he was about emerging market debt. Now, Asia typically has managed to grow without recourse to lots of debt. It's a bit of generalization, but essentially equity capital markets have been strong. They've grown in a way that, you know, South America hasn't. South America's been more debt dependent, but therein lies potential opportunity. What are you seeing in the world of emerging market, and let's just talk about, you know, but you can talk about the whole Santander experience, but emerging market debt and a little bit the local currency versus the dollarized debt.
Absolutely. And I'll, again, I guess, to your point, you're right that it still covers so many other countries that usually will be Asia. But if you think at, for example, the FX and how liquid the markets are, the Mexican peso, Turkish lira are the most liquid in terms of the emerging market from an FX perspective, by far. So that should give, or usually does give, a lot of comfort for PM managers when doing EMD to be doing, yes, Turkish lira, but I'll talk about Latin America and therefore the FX on Mexico. I also believe that there's a huge opportunity in Latin American debt. When you look at the interest rates that we've seen, and I again will use the two biggest countries, I mean, they've all have started coming down much faster than the developed countries because they started before increasing their interest rates, unlike us over here in the developed markets. But Brazil still stands at 11% and Mexico still stands like at 8%. And you still see a lot of the appetite wanting the FX back into dollars, but there are numerous investors that do like to have the exposure in local currency. But that usually goes hand in hand with someone wanting or feeling more comfortable with higher risk.
One of the things I've noted in your commentary is you have referred to the deficiencies in financial education. I think around the world, we grapple with the fact that young people generally aren't as conversant as they should be, and that goes all the way up. As you think about, and I'm staying here with Latin American in the investment community, particularly the individual community, where would you say they are in that financial educational journey?
And I wish it was still just with the younger generations. I think that mostly in Latin America, it lies more with the fact that there's a big divide from a societal perspective. So you will find that across Latin America, there's a huge deficiency in terms of financial education. And this time, really, we as Santander spend a lot of time and money on working on that in these countries. And particularly, again, but not just Mexico and Brazil, because we also do Colombia and Peru. But we have been spending a lot of time there. And I'll talk about maybe two different ways in which we've done so. Mexico has a program called Tuyo. Brazil has a program called Prospera that is more about financial education as well as lending money to those who normally don't have access to banking products because they're not banked. And in Brazil, it's much better than it is in Mexico. It's at around 80% of people are within the banking system. In Mexico, it doesn't even get to 40%. So there's an incredible amount of people that are like in an informal sector and therefore are not banked. So both Tuyo and Prospera give access to people that normally can't work with a bank because of the type of work that they do or whatever they need to prove to be able to say, you can lend me money. And that will always come accompanied with financial education. And then the other piece that I think that as Santander we're less known for is we spend a lot of time and money on universities. And that really means spending a lot of time in terms of educating and working with entrepreneurs as well to really be able to build their businesses. If I'm not mistaken, we're top three in the world as a private company in terms of the money that we give to universities. So I'm a big believer, especially for Latin America that still has a long way to go, that this will be an important path in making more people financial literate and hopefully being more independent in their decisions.
And as you step back and look above all your geographies and all your businesses, where would you expect the bulk of your growth to occur in the next few years?
Fair question. And I now kind of felt a little bad that we were going on and on about Latin America. And then people will be thinking, oh, it's because she's Mexican. But no, our biggest chunk of our business, our biggest chunk of the business is certainly in Spain, because that's where we come from. I'm very grateful to the business that we have in Spain. But without a doubt, when I turn around and think about where are the big countries of growth, those are in Latin America. And it's certainly Mexico and Brazil, given their size and the fact that it's still both countries, very young countries, that where the demographics should really accompany us in terms of people moving from savers to investors and hopefully for us to be able to be part of that investment part of their lives.
And I would suggest that you have a recognized, trusted brand, which is helpful because it's a business where, you know, there is a understandable level of skepticism after the financial crisis. I'm also struck that in reading some of your materials, you've talked about female representation in the investment industry. Ana Botín is your chair. You're running a very big business within Santander. How do you think, and we've partnered with GAIN here in the UK, which is the nonprofit organization, what does the industry need to do to encourage more women to go into finance and stay in finance? Because it's the latter that is often the issue.
Absolutely. I think we're still at incredibly low levels. I think the last I read is women in finance in senior positions, I think, still don't go above 12%. So that's still incredibly low, depressingly low. And you're absolutely right in saying that it's not only about getting into finance, but it's staying in finance. So I can at least talk to what we have been doing. And then maybe I'll just add my personal thoughts on it is we have been, at least within Santander Asset Management, is I really made sure that we always have very competitive, where people really sit down and decide who are we going to be choosing either for a promotion or for a hire. And that we always make sure that we have women within these. Because otherwise, I think that often you have people just going more towards the people that they know. And what that has mean, what it shows in numbers is that I joined 2 years ago, we've increased senior women in positions by 65% by really ensuring that we have very transparent and meritocratic and open processes when hiring or when promoting people. But addressing then the point of having people stay, I really believe that there's a huge component of a network and people feeling comfortable that they have other women there with them and role modeling. And I've really worked on the fact of ensuring that all of the senior women that we have within Santander Asset Management, that we're all really available and open and vocal about how we got to where we're at and how we can help others get there. And thirdly, I would say, and this is goes for everyone, is in the remaining part, I think being able to show that we can be flexible in terms of whether it's men or women, how they want to spend their time at work is incredibly important. But again, the role modeling, both from women and men, is going to be key to ensuring that people want to work in a place like ours and feel that they have the same opportunities, whether women or men.
Well, we interviewed Hanneke Smits from Bank of New York Mellon the other day, and she obviously chairs the 30% Club, and that's the level at which female participation tends to have a very much more positive effect in terms of those conversations and good processes. But she also made this, alluded, and I had not heard this before, that when you look at the number of female CEOs in the S&P 500 at 10%, it equates with the number of CEOs whose Christian name is John. So work to be done. All of our conversation has really focused on the public market activities, debt and equity, that you undertake. And of course, the world has, I was engorged on private assets, but there's been an explosion in private assets courtesy of cheap rates and lots of other factors, companies staying private longer, etc. I think you've been fairly careful about your entrance into this market. Tell me, what's your thinking about where you are and how you want to approach it?
You're absolutely right. Everyone seems to be wanting to jump into private markets and everyone at the same time, or some later than others. So I definitely think that there are three big trends in the asset management industry that are here and here to stay. One is passive, second is technology or digitization, and thirdly is private markets. We really believe that we can have, as Santander as a group, a real edge on private markets. A lot of people will come and say, don't you think you're a bit late to the party? And the answer is probably yes, but I still think that there's a lot to be done. And the reason why I do think that there's a place for us in here is, and I heard another conversation that you interviewed someone on private equity. Oh, she was the CIO of CPPI, I think it was.
Must have been. See you again.
And it was very much about how important origination is. And for example, if you're Santander Asset Management, there is a fair amount of origination that can come from Santander as the group. I mean, Santander as a group is an incredibly important player in the infrastructure space, private debt, and private credit, for example. And that's like to name a few. So I think that we can have a really big edge on origination. I also believe that it goes a really long way to say that you have the backing of a group like Santander. When I'm coming in and launching a product and I'm inviting you to be a co-investor, if I also say that we've invested 20% out of Santander's money, I'm sure that will also make you feel much more comfortable in terms of what you're investing in. And thirdly, we are working towards building a really strong team. We're now a 73 strong people team, and we are looking at growing organically and inorganically. But we want to make sure that we're very good at few asset classes, probably those where we can have a big edge by being a group like Santander, and then to do joint ventures where we believe we don't have any special sauce in it, and we might as well work with someone alongside them and be able to also help in the distribution through the enormous distribution channel that is Santander.
And overall, we are sitting here in 5 years' time, how would you judge your tenure as being successful?
So overall, I would say that I would like to see our assets double in the next 5 years. So that would be, from a number perspective, my KPI. But my second important KPI would be I want to make sure that Santander Asset Management is a place where people love coming to work every day. We haven't spoken about culture, but it is something that I am very grateful from the places I've worked in before. How important that is for these companies. And I want to make sure that I'm bringing that into where I am today. And that being a culture where everyone feels they can be part of something and that they can grow within that firm.
And let's stay with it, because you're so right. It differentiates the good and the less good firms in terms of succession and reinforcing, you know, critical values. It's a tall order. How do you go about trying to embed important cultural sort of values and shared, you know, ways of behaving?
So I think that's something that one has to remind oneself every day. I think I've never valued culture as much as I have now in this role. I don't know if it's because I'm a CEO or because I sit in a place that is maybe more from one type of country than others, but I've certainly learned that culture really makes such a difference for everyone. And I want to make sure that I am always a very inclusive and meritocratic leader, because I know it can be easier to just give orders. I think that makes it easier for everyone. But I also really believe that if people are going down the journey with you because they believe in it and believe in you and the team, it makes such a bigger difference than just doing it because you're told.
So what was interesting when I did my research and I went through the normal process of seeing what was out there, what people who were Googling Santander would see, I saw quite a lot of links related to savings products and ISAs, and you've got this footprint. Tell me a little bit about, we're sitting in the UK, what your aspirations are.
So as much as we're certainly such a relevant player in the UK in the mortgage space, I would very much like to see, and that's certainly towards where we're working, is how do we make sure that we're working with that customer from just having a mortgage to having savings and having investments with Santander? And we're certainly spending the time to make sure that we're delivering on that and that we're really able to deliver something that's personalized to the client here in the UK, and that we're moving them not just from mortgages, but also into investments.
I've got two closing questions. Is that this is a business where perhaps, as I would say, more than any, you are bombarded with information on a daily basis. Information, and that's not your regular email diet. That's just the investment content. How do you manage that overload?
So there are a couple of things I always make sure I read and or listen to. So I will spend a fair amount of time on the Wall Street Journal and the FT in trying to get just a feel of what's moving around, who's buying what, where are the flows going to, and so on and so forth. And I have to say that I should probably expand it to more than that in terms of my daily reading, but those are the places where I certainly get enough for my day-to-day. I think something else that is important in all of this, and you were mentioning before, you've joined a couple of conferences in the last couple of weeks. I think that is always very telling as well. Going to a couple of very selected events and really making sure that you're really going to listen to what's going on in the investment world. And last but not least, consultants. Some pieces of research that they do. I also have my preferred selected ones that I read more than others. But I think around twice a year, I always make sure I sit down with a big consultant to get a feel for what are they seeing in terms of trends in the asset management world.
Yeah. Well, I would say, having interviewed some folks at the London Value Investor Conference a few weeks ago, that was very insightful. And as I may have mentioned, more people there interested in the value space than I've seen. Berlin Super Returns, very different. It's this enormous gathering of the private asset world, which is also sort of quite eye-opening and some very interesting conversations. I think actually you said you read the FT, you read the Wall Street Journal. I think just add to that the Money Maze podcast and you're probably set with all you ever needed in terms of investment content.
Absolutely.
And my final question, because we do have this important youthful cohort listening to us. You obviously do a lot of work around universities. So young listeners who are thinking about businesses generally, a piece of advice, if you could tell us just one thing.
When I'm interviewing younger people, and people always want to be jumping from one thing to the next because they think otherwise they get bored, I often do think that sticking to one thing for at least 2 years to get a real grasp for what you're working on and doing would be my piece of advice. I'm sure they have enough going on in terms of what's the next big thing they should be doing. So for that crowd, I would certainly say stick 2 years to the one job that you picked you were going to be in.
Got it. Well, it's been terrific to meet you and to talk about Santander's business, which I, you know, up to a few weeks ago didn't know, you know, anything about. And you do sit in this unusual seat of being a doorway into Latin America. And having talked about emerging market debt, I didn't know actually the Turkish lira and the Mexican peso were the two most liquid currencies in that space. And I think it's telling beyond those thinking about emerging market and wanting exposure, you know, inbound, also how the opportunities for the export of capital will continue. But you said the three things that typify, in your mind, the investment industry going forward are growth of passive, digitalization, and private markets. And my suspicion is there will be some hiccups in the private market world along the way, courtesy of the repricing of capital. I think it's happening now, from what I can see in the private debt space, where there's some workouts beginning and some thinking, and private equity's backed up in terms of being able to sell some of the assets they might have hoped and get the realizations. And from that come the reinvestments into the funds. So indigestion might be a euphemism, but you're right, private markets selectively are not going away. So Samantha, it's been a great pleasure to have you here on the Money Maze podcast.
It's been so much fun to be here, and I'll make sure that Money Maze is on my daily listening.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.